Well, hey there, peoples. We are brought to you today by the Groove Washer, the world's bestest ever record cleaner. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record shop and accept no substitutes.
It's Groove Washer or die, baby.
And hey, we're also brought to you today by AudiophileUSA.com. Only excellent and near mint used vinyl, some still sealed, all still gorgeous. That's AudiophileUSA.com. Search, dig, and grab the deals. And with that, on with the show. Well, hey everyone, it's Nate. Thanks for tuning into this week's episode of The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors, music nerds, and the undeniably handsome. You are certainly in the right place here. This is episode 325, and we have a great guest today. Ambrose Kenny Smith of the Murlocs and King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard joins us today to talk records, recordings, rare vinyl, the early days of the Melbourne music boom, and heaps more. Plus, we get some glimpses into what's next for both King Gizzard and the Murlocs. Oh, and by the way, if you are unfamiliar with the Murlocs, I strongly recommend picking up some of their vinyl. Their newish album is Bittersweet Demons, with gorgeous vinyl pressings available at flightlessrecords.com, or just straight up go to unclemerle.com. There's different web stores for different continents. Bittersweet Demons is a great place to start. So is Manic Candid Episode. That is one of my favorite Murlocs albums. And of course, you can see Ambrose and the Murlocs currently on tour, or catch him later this year with King Gizzard. Dates for those shows are up at gizverse.com. Oh, and one last thing. If you like this episode, make sure to subscribe to the Vinyl Guide podcast for other interviews, such as episode 301 with Amel and the Sniffers, episodes 318 and 319 with Australian legend Dave Tice of Buffalo, episode 299, all on the bootleg record label Trademark of Quality, episode 256 with Eamon Sandwith of the Chats, episode 255 with Andy Partridge of XTC, episode 242 with Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth, episode 219 with Matt Cameron of Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, and heaps more episodes. Subscribe to the Vinyl Guide on your podcast app. Scroll and enjoy. And with that, let's get into our conversation with Mr. Ambrose Kenny Smith. Ambrose, how are you?
Yep. Yeah, I can hear you.
Cool. I just quickly set up a microphone because, yeah, I just can't stand listening to podcasts that are just like through their phone and stuff.
Hey, you know what you can do? If you record the WAV file, you could ship that over to me and then I'll sandwich them together.
Yeah, I'm going to do that. Yeah, so I'm going to do. I got some bit of a demolition happening in my backyard today. It was supposed to happen on Wednesday, and then it was like got pushed to today, and then just before I was just like, oh god, I gotta like try and isolate, set up a microphone or something. So it should be fine. It's pretty chill.
That's fine. Look, I've had to edit out UPS people delivering stuff, and you know, dogs barking. Sometimes it's part of the charm though. You hear the birds chirping and stuff. Yeah, so
yeah, it's cool. It's like, I don't know, it's heavy metal.
But we appreciate your attention to the audiophile nature of our listeners. So
yeah, sweet. Cool.
Oh, good nice. To see you, man. Hey, how have things been? You know, I know I was supposed to see King Giz tomorrow, but that show's been canceled. Oh. But I can see the Murlocs in like 10 days. So kind of it's a really kind of strange environment. Some shows can go forward and some shows can't. Mm. Have you figured out the logic of that yet?
Yeah, it's such a debacle. Shows are pretty all over the shop. I don't know. It's all just been so dicey, and then it's a crazy, stressful time, as it always feels like it is. But yeah, it's just intense when it comes down to sort of my decision at the end of the day, you know, or like the band's decision. And it's not so much like the money thing. It's just also just like the safety part of it as well, and jeopardizing more shows, bigger shows, you know, just so much work and things go into it that makes the stress levels way worse when.
I could tell you're conflicted by it. Just, you know, you're the way you speak about it.
Yeah. Because it's like, you know, you always full steam ahead, and then the last, you know, the week or so out, you really start contemplating so many things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I guess not just like COVID, just like everything. I don't know. You want the show to be as good as possible. You don't want to be just kind of bummed out about it, you know, because the show's supposed to be, it's for the fans, but it's also for yourself as well. You know, you got to mm-hmm. be happy with what you're doing.
So with Murlocs, you are, I guess, the decision maker, right? You're the center of
yeah.
that. Where Gizzard, you're a bit more of a passenger, or at least part of a collective. Is there a role? Which one do you feel most comfortable in?
Equally, I've always questioned those things between the two, but yeah, I enjoy both of it. Like, I don't mind doing the Murloc stuff, like, you know, like co-managing and, you know, pretty much doing a lot of things, making a lot of things happen for no pay, you know, it's for the love. And, you know, all those guys, they were my best friends, you know, so I'm happy to try and make it work as much as I can, because I always have that guilt of being in King Gizzard and being so busy with King Gizzard that, you know, whenever I get the time to do the Murlocs, I really just try and do as much as I can, because I feel like I really owe it to them as well, for mm-hmm. for them, for standing by me for 10 years, you know. So yeah, and we also, I just love the music we make we make together in both projects. I get the best out of everything in both things, you know. I learned so much from both these mm-hmm. days. I think it was always like learning things from Gizzard to take to Murlocs, but then now it's all sort of just like having my head around like the industry more and how things happen. It's beneficial in both ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, listening to Murlocs and just the album to album to album, the growth of the band and perhaps you as a songwriter has been really tremendous, really, over the last 10 years. Just to see where you're going. If you go back and you listen to Loopholes, you know, uh-huh. I mean, it's, you know, it's good. It's standard. But with each yeah. release, you see a lot of growth. And I would imagine a lot of that comes from the community you're in, getting ideas from Gizzard, just growing as an individual. I mean, do you recognize that sort of growth in your songwriting?
Totally. Yeah, I think that's what just keeps it going with the Murlocs as well. Like, you know, I feel like we're a fine wine these days. I think we have a new album that's going to be out later in the year, and we just almost finished mixing the one after that. And yeah, we seem to just keep being like more prolific as we're getting older and more like aware of our songwriting and how we want to like create things, and what, like, we can already kind of like at least I can hear in my head what the song needs to be from like someone's demo, you know. And I've sort of encouraged everyone as well always to like write more and stuff, because like Murlocs should be a vessel for everyone to be, you know, getting mm-hmm. something out of it. No one should be in the back seat, like, you know, it's a team effort. Mm-hmm. Because that's what Gizzard is like as well, as well. You know, as we both bands evolve, it's all becoming way more and more collaborative, and it makes it way funner. Mm-hmm. Everyone gets way more out of it, and just makes you want to keep doing it. You know,
you mentioned earlier that you may have a bit of guilt with Murlocs as a project, because it sometimes maybe it plays, you know, second.
Yeah, the shadow.
Yeah,
yeah.
Did the whole COVID lockdowns in Melbourne, where you were forced to stay home and forced to, and you couldn't tour. Was that a bit of a mixed blessing?
Yeah, it actually was. The first 6 months or so, I was, you know, like everyone, really depressed and just like, just really confused, questioning my existence and what I did. And I always just felt like more of a performer than a musician. I never really like been in both bands and being a keen skateboarder and doing other things, I never really like stupidly didn't sit down for long enough and try and really like work on my craft as much as I wish I did, you know. I was very lazy in that department. So now I feel like I'm just been trying to play catch up for this whole pandemic. So I think nowadays I can finally classify myself as a musician and more and a recording artist, I guess, because I think before that I always felt like I was just more of a performer. I looked way more forward to performing and interacting and yeah, that sort of whole stage setup. But now, thanks to the pandemic, it is a blessing in disguise that I've definitely gone the other way. Now I'm really into making records and stuff.
Okay. All right. You got, I could tell because you say you've got two other Murlocs albums already.
Yeah.
In a and very the finalized Mountain of state. Gizzards.
Yeah.
So you guys have been equally prolific with King Gizzard. There's a couple albums backlog there as well, you know?
Yeah. We've managed to put out three since the pandemic and we've got always got like so much just to work mm-hmm. on. There's always multiple projects in the pipeline. So yeah, I guess it's just always just depends on what one we feel like finishing off, I guess.
So let's go back. Normally in these conversations, I talk about, you know, the records of your youth and did you grow mm-hmm. up in a musical family? It's pretty clear that you did. I mean, your dad's pretty much an Aussie music legend. I mean, he performed on Morning of the Earth soundtrack, which is, you know.
Yeah, yeah. yeah, that's definitely a highlight.
Was music kind of a foregone conclusion? Was it a given in your house that you would play music and that was the direction you'd go?
Yeah. My dad just naturally played so much blues music. So that's just like ingrained in me pretty hardcore. I can't listen to anything for too long that you can't dance to or like feel something from. I struggle to get into some things. Like I appreciate like the shit out of it, you know, like everything, but I just have this thing that's just the core to me and like the key to my heart is just, you know, just Delta blues pretty much at the end of the day. So yeah, from a young age, I was just, you know, once I was listening to hearing Muddy Waters and Sonny Terry and John Lee Hooker and, you know, Sonny Boy Williamson and, you know, list goes on. I saw Blues Brothers and then that was it. And then when I saw the movie Blues Brothers, I was like, this is the best thing in the world. Like this is it. So I used to sit there with it. This like you have one of those heaters with the grills on it. And I used to put bits of bread with like a fork against that and watch it. And because I wanted to be, Alwood so bad that I like would just eat like plain bits of toast because now he gets like, you know, it's like two whole fried chickens and a Coke.
Yeah. I was going to say, you could have gone the other way. Yeah. You could have.
Yeah. Yeah. Fried yeah. Chickens. Well, I'm going that way now. Yeah.
Look, if the last thing that I hear on this planet is Ray Charles's version of Shake Your Tail Feather, I'm fine with that. You know?
Yeah. Sign me up too. Yeah. That'd be a great way to go.
Was there a record that you brought home that your family was kind of like, I don't know about this. It was very much something that generated outside of the house.
Yeah, I reckon. I like can distinctively, for some reason, you know, in that confused state as a kid, I remember like getting Big Willie Styles, like Will Smith, like the single on a CD, getting jiggy with it. And then like, it wasn't soon after that that I just became obsessed with like, yeah, Muddy Waters and stuff. But other than that, I remember buying that single and get like, you know, Christmas, like Batman Forever soundtrack, like just smash, like Seal, Kiss from a Rose and stuff. But, yeah, pretty much I didn't have many like 180s like that. I sort of just had those one or two initial things. I was like, yeah, I think this is cool. And then I was like, oh wait, no, this is cool. And then like, I used to fall asleep every night listening to those records, like just like the bootlegs. I used to go on bus. So Blues Brothers movie was like it. I used to get my mom to buy me this real cheap like kid's suit and I would go to this like market and I would busk for like hours just playing harmonica, just like just trying to wing it. Like because once I like dad taught me how to like bend a note, I was just like just went with it and I would go down there and just like try and wail for hours and then I'd get all my coins and go over to this music stand this dude Werner, he would have this music stand and he would have all these like bootlegs of like all the blues dudes. And I would just, I didn't know any better. I thought they were the real thing, but I was just like, yeah, I just bought like every one of them all the time. That's what I spent all the money on. And then I'd go home and put on my ghetto blaster and fall asleep listening to them.
Wow.
So that's how obsessed I was. Yeah.
Yeah. I would imagine your parents were very, very supportive in that, especially with the music that your dad was known for. I mean, he must have, tilt you that way? Did he tell you what was good? He let you find your own way.
He was encouraging a bit, but not hugely. Mum was way more like, you know, go for it. And she was the one that would drive me to the market, to busking, to the festivals, like, and I'd busk out the front of the front gate. And she really was the one that backed me the hardest. Dad was more on the other end at times. You know, I think he was just freaked out and, you know, he's in his late 40s. You know, by this point, because he had me in his like early 40s or something. And I think by this point, you know, he's kind of freaking out about me trying to become a musician, you know, and he's like, oh, you know, just stay in school, be a doctor or a lawyer, you know, like, oh, like sort of things. And I think out of spite, you know, I was always like, no, I'm going to stick it to you. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to show you what's up. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I've kind of gotten to that point now, and it feels weird because now I'm like, it sort of went a few years ago when I felt like I reached that mark, and he said, like, you know, people say, oh, you must be so proud of your son, and he's like, I'm not proud because you did it yourself. And I'll always be like, bastard, now I just want more. Like, so he was kind of always good at like treating it mean to keep him keen, but but also supportive as well, you know, like it's a different approach as opposed to my mom, who was just like, yeah, like, go for it.
Well, your dad, when being a musician, especially his style of musician when he was, you know, doing it kind of in the early 70s, very different world. I mean, the playing gigs interstate in Australia was very difficult.
That was the thing.
You know, it was a hard road. You've got a very different environment now.
Yeah, like I can't even imagine, like, yeah, his idea of touring would be like 2 months of like just going into the next state, you know, maybe the one after that, but pretty much just playing like every bloody crevice throughout the whole thing, you know. Mm-hmm. So
if you really wanted to, when you're touring, you could go somewhere, play a show in Australia, come back. You wouldn't even have to get someone to look after the cat. Right? You can enough food for a day or so and get back. They were driving these 2-lane roads between Toorak and, you know, Canberra. It was a hard
life. It's just so hard to, I remember like as a young age, like, you know, experiencing these festivals and these pubs where they're always packed in the middle of nowhere, you know, before the internet and stuff. So it was like, those days, it's just kind of sad that it doesn't really exist, or it only exists for like that sort of era of dudes, you know, or like, I don't know, anyone, like that sort of crowd can go back to these towns, and those old crew, if they're still kicking, they'll go down the pub and see him, like your Jimmy Barnes or whatever. Like, I don't know. Like, it seems like that's not really an option for bands my age these days, unless you're like, you know, smashed on like the radio, you know, or like it's really funny to think how different it kind of is in that sense, because our touring sense of Australia has always just been like Sydney, you know, Brisbane, just the main cities, and that's kind of it. Because then once you start trying to venture out rurally, it's sort of like doesn't always feel like it's worth it, you know, some of the time.
Yeah, well, there are exceptions to that. I'll give you an example. Tonight I'm going to see the Cosmic Psychos,
right? Oh yeah, sweet. Yeah.
So they will be, and I'm sure people will be,
that's
coming out,
that's a band
to
that could do that. Yeah, that's sort of like, yeah, those guys. And yeah, I don't know, it's different worlds, yeah, for sure. There's crew like that can seem to always pull some sort of crowd in the middle of nowhere.
So when you connected with the guys in King Giz, were you friends first or were you a band first? Was the purpose of coming together to play music?
The way it sort of happened was I was in a band with Lucas, the bass player from Gizzard, and we had a blues band called Sambro's Automobile, and that started with my best mates, Sam Cooper. Me and Sam started playing when we were like in like when we were like 10 or something. But yeah, and then I think it was pretty much like from there. Then Lucas joined a few years later, and then after like once we sort of got to like 16, 17, maybe like 15 or something, we played this. Lucas organized this house party because he lived in Geelong and me and Sam lived on the coast. And we went to this house party and it was like Stu and Cook from Gizzard were playing in their band Revolver and Son. And that's where we saw them play for the first time. And then we all met each other then. And we were like, I'm like 15, they're like 16, 17 or something. Mm-hmm. Kind of, it sort of got to the point where I was finishing high school and those guys were like in uni in Melbourne and Stu had started King Gizzard. And I was like, I think everyone sort of knew that Stu was like better than everyone else. And then he just sort of came out of left field and it just hit the ground running. And once I saw them play, I was just like in my head, I was like, I want to play in this band real bad. And then he asked me to play harmonica like the next week. And then I just kept rocking up.
Okay. Pretty much. Was the name King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard already established?
That was what the name was when I saw them. I think a little bit before that, they were Sea of Trees at the very beginning. I think they did like one show, maybe two shows. But it was all within a matter of like weeks and months. Like it was so quick. I remember just like hearing about them and then all of a sudden seeing it and then being like, all right, this is why it's so buzzy. Because yeah, it was just like, you know, all these people on stage just going ballistic with three chords. And I think at the time, we were all just trying to be like pretty 60s garage pop, kind of like, you know, like real trying to craft our songs. Like everyone's trying to be like Bob Dylan at 16 and stuff. And then like, then they just got on stage and just had all this angst and like energy that everyone, I think, was lacking at the time. And that's why it just sort of caught the attention of everyone.
It's really interesting because, I've been around a few decades, I think, longer, and I've seen, like, these different scenes pop up, right? I remember when there was the L.A., the Hollywood heavy metal scene, or the Northeast kind of grunge scene, and it's interesting what happens, because you don't really recognize it's something special until you have a little bit of distance and time away from it. And
yeah, totally.
That's kind of the way I'm seeing what's happened over the last decade in Melbourne with King Gizzard and Murlocs and Orb and Amel and the Sniffers. And, you know, there seems to be a real identity there. And I don't know.
Yeah.
You were in the center of it. I mean, did you feel it was special at the time?
Yeah, I definitely feel nostalgic and, you know, happy when I think about it, for sure. Because it was so much going on. There were so many bands, and us being from the coast and from Geelong, I feel like there was just so many more like better bands in Geelong than Melbourne at the time. Like, because it was just everyone was like trying to do this garage thing so much. Like the Nuggets compilations and all those things were like huge for us. So I think everyone was just sort of trying to go down that road, when everyone in Melbourne was just trying to be like Jet and stuff, or like, I don't know. It was just kind of like, it was all different, but Melbourne was, there wasn't much of a, didn't feel like a community core as such, like Geelong being the smaller, you know, city sister to it felt like the scene there was a lot more like tight knit, and just sort of like aware of, like everyone was kind of trying to do the same thing, but in their own flavor. And that sort of created heaps of really cool music.
Yeah. Was there ever any talk or hope or aspiration of working with a financier or major label? Or was the plan and the thought always to be self-financed, that sort of thing?
We'll be back after these messages.
Hey everyone, let me tell you about AudiophileUSA.com. AudiophileUSA.com is a fantastic place to buy used records online. AudiophileUSA.com has a heap of inventory, like tens of thousands of records you can search through online, and they are all excellent and near mint quality. These are your final upgrades, beautiful records that you can enjoy for years to come. AudiophileUSA.com is a family-owned and operated business, and they work hard to find the absolute cleanest records in the world and make them available to you. Head up there now, AudiophileUSA.com, search and dig through their selection and find the deals. Get a box of love on its way to you now from AudiophileUSA.com. Now, I know that you know that the Groove Washer is the best record cleaner in the world, but did you know that Groove Washer now makes archival quality record sleeves too? Yep, the world's best record cleaner is now making some fantastic sleeves and record accessories for a limited time introductory offer. The Groove Washer Groove Guard record sleeves are absolutely fantastic, so head up there now and try them for yourself. Go to groovewasher.com and use discount code VINYLGUIDE10. That's the Groove Washer record cleaners, record sleeves, and other protection for your record collection. That's groovewasher.com.
Now we return to the program, already in progress.
No limits. Was there ever any talk or hope or aspiration of working with a financier or major label? Or was the plan and the thought always to be self-financed, that sort of thing?
No, I think the plan, well, there was never really much of a plan. I think it's just with Gizzard was the first band that came along with the plan, I guess. It was sort of just like, they're all at uni doing music industry course or whatever, and they just made King Gizzard the course, like their topic or whatever, their subject. Like that was, they just turned the band into like the thing for uni. But so I think that's why it just like took so much momentum so quickly, because they were just like figuring out pretty much what not to do. I think that's what I gauge from when I talked to Stu about what it was like for them. I sort of took all, like they realized that they could just do things so much more differently, and there's ways to do it. And also we were just like, yeah, we're moving fast, we're getting lots of attention, but also no one wanted to touch us either at the time. So we just like took the initiative and just did things like ourselves.
That's incredibly brave. Because there's that safety of the major label and, these other records I listened to were on this label. We could be associated with that. And perhaps even the temptation to maybe alter a little bit of what we feel now makes King Gizzard and the Murloc special, to alter that or even compromise to be able to meet the expectations of someone who can provide that kind of roadmap. So the fact that you guys struck out on your own, I think is tremendously refreshing and very brave.
It is very brave for sure. But I think the sad thing is that we just knew that we're never going to be this commercial rock band, you know, that sometimes people like, you know, publishers and labels and stuff, sometimes it will work with, I've kind of always just like, oh, I wish you would just, you know, go to this studio that we recommend and spend all this money and use this big hotshot producer and, you know, really just do this nice polished, like commercially successful rock album. And it's sort of just like, nah, like fuck that. Like it's that, and that I've always wondered about that, because I've always just been at times like, oh, I kind of want to like just do one like really banging, like, you know, big album and really go for it. But Stu's just, it's not him, right? As well, and it's good, because it's helped us create our own identity and get this more of a cult following. And you know, because I think at the end of the day we could have probably pulled it off as well if we wanted to go and try be some mainstream thing, but I think we all just are way more into the music and inspirations and things that aren't that, you know? Right. So it just would feel not quite right. And if it happens, you know, one day, it will just happen naturally. You know, it's not going to be like force.
You think there's still potential for that? I think you guys have proven the formula extraordinarily well. And
yeah, for sure. But it'd be really funny and kind of it'd be ironic as well if something just took off in a sense that we weren't expecting. But who knows? It's not like we're going out of our way looking for it, you know.
You know, it's interesting because it seems, especially with King Gizzard, the albums a lot of times have these gimmicks. You know, mm-hmm. the micro-tuning yeah. album or the, you know, Nonagon Infinity or, you know, Quarters. Every song is 10 minutes and 10 seconds. It's just, it's bizarre. It wouldn't be out of place for you guys to think of, okay, let's do one album that's just like a Bob Rock produced kind of mega.
that's a good like concept twist I should put on Stu. Like, hey man, I got this idea. It's crazy, right?
Get Tony Visconti and all those
guys. Yeah, we got Rick Rubin and like, yeah, I think that will never happen. But maybe it will. I don't know. He changes his mind all the time.
So crazy it just may work.
We'll run out of concepts, that's for sure.
So do you guys pitch around those concepts back and forth? Like for instance, Infest the Rat's Nest, it was just time for a heavy mm-hmm. metal album. Like how do those ideas germinate?
I like to think that one sort of happened like those like Cavs, Joe and Stu made that record pretty much like solely them three, and they've just always been the keen metalheads. Me, Lucas and Cook, maybe not so much. Maybe Cook and Lucas more me, probably at the end of the spectrum. But seeing them play that stuff and do it, it's like, I was just like, holy shit, these guys are like insanely good at doing this kind of genre. And it's probably the genre that we should probably stick to the most. But it's also just so sick how we can just, they can just go and do that. And then it's like, all right, cool. Fucking nailed that. And what are you going to do? Like try to do another metal album. And it's going to be hard to try and do it and not just sound like Rat's Nest 2. But yeah, that sort of was, we got to a point where we're like, I was like, oh, we should all, someone's, I don't know. I remember being like, we all should pick a concept album that everyone wants to do like a style. And I was like, I want to do a boogie album. So we like were like cool, and then so that was the first one when we came up with this idea of everyone does their own sort of album. We'll try follow their lead, and we did Fishing for Fishies, and it kind of didn't really turn out that way. But I feel like it's so hard to pull off that, like, you know, I was wanting it to be some sort of Stones Canned Heat, like, you know, we'll just go to some house in like French Villa or something, but like, you know, a lot of the time that stuff is just doesn't really work, and like it's all about the vibe and like, you know, the moment and stuff. So that one kind of turned out a bit wacky. I still really like it, but so after that the guys were like, all right, time for the metal album. And sort of it was kind of like good timing in the end, because me and Cook end up going on tour with Murlocs for Manic Candid Episode. Like we had so much, we wanted to, tour the States and Europe and sort of make up for a lot of lost time that Murlocs has missed out on for touring. So we kind of, Gizzard was like, we're taking 6 months off. And me and Cook were like, okay, cool. We're going to go and do like, you know, about 3 or so months of Murlocs touring. And then it was sort of like an unspoken thing at the time, but it sort of worked out in the best way possible, I think, because if we hadn't been touring with Murlocs and they were doing that album, I would have just been twiddling my thumbs for like a lot of that period, because, you know, that those records should be just corely guitars and like a three piece really, you know? And then if there's anything to add, you just do it later to the piece. But so they just went to town on Rat's Nest while we were touring and doing Manic Candid Episode stuff with Murlocs. And I remember being in the van and like with Murlocs, we'd wake up, we'd be driving to the next show, and me and Cook would be on our laptops, like with our like MIDI keyboards, trying to like add synths or like trying to do something to it. And we're both just looking at each other like,
what do we do?
I don't think there's anything we can really do on this record, which is cool, but it's just funny how it's working out. But yeah, and then that's how that one went down pretty much.
something like Quarters, where every song is 10 minutes and 10 seconds. Like, it wasn't mm-hmm. that you guys had a couple of songs that were kind of around that length, and then you said, you know what, let's just, the concept is the time of each of the songs. Like, how does that kind of come up?
I think that was just sort of I can't even remember the conversation, because I think I just had like food poisoning at the time. We're in Brooklyn, and I remember, well, I have footage on my GoPro, whatever, the time where I set up, and we're just at the Knitting Factory. We'd hired it out for the day, and we're jamming in there, and I think we're working on like River or like one of those songs on Quarters, and I just run off the stage and I start, yeah, shitting, munting yeah. everywhere and stuff. And Eric takes me back to the Airbnb, and I'm just like curdled in like the bed for a couple days, pretty much. And in those couple days, you know, in Gizzard world is like a couple weeks. So it just kind of like, I kind of came to, and they already like had the songs down and were going into Daptone. And yeah. And then, but I just like, end up recording harp. Like, some of the harp is recorded like in the van when we're like touring in Europe. We just like put a mic through the headrest, through the back of the headrest, and I'd be sitting behind Stu just like playing the harmonica when we'd go through the like Euro tunnel to France and stuff. So it was also, and then we hired a room in like London for like a day or something, and I did the stuff, and it was all kind of like, I don't know, it was just like those, it was just based around the four jams, but the 10 minute 10 second thing, I can't remember how that ended up just being like it always just comes down to Stu just being like mad scientist moment,
right? Okay.
Yeah,
the 12 Bar Brews album, or EP, or however it's classified now, when you guys first decided to put that out, I mean, you guys chose the vinyl format before it was, you know, the real vinyl revival kind of kicked in. What was mm-hmm. your thinking about that? You know, King Gizzard's always been a vinyl heavy band. What was the conversation about releasing that on vinyl when vinyl wasn't the cool thing at the time?
Yeah, I never really thought of it like that, I guess, but you're right. I guess we were buying records at the time and pretty into records. So it just made sense to try and do one, because everyone, we sort of were hanging around, and our friend, we knew that our friends would probably buy it. So I guess it was just sort of, yeah, it was, yeah. Now you talk about it, it was pretty of a bold move, I guess. Cause, with Murlocs, I was just like, cool, here's our CD. Is that a cool little CD, you know, cardboard slip, cool, you know, like, and then, yeah. And then after that record, it was like, you know, I think it's also, we just owe a lot of our success to Jason Galea as well. All the artwork and everything he's done for us has just really shaped us. Mm-hmm. So having him from the get-go has just been a huge benefit.
Yeah, well, you want to show his art in a large format.
Exactly,
having it on a little CD is a little bit would mm-hmm. be hard to do it. What were the expectations of that record? I mean, did they sell through quick? Right now, a 12 bar Brews, I'm sure you know, 12 bar Brews.
One point, no expensive. Yeah, the originals. Yeah, well, I think we only did like 500 or something. And I don't know. I don't remember it selling too fast, but like, yeah, they were definitely gone. But like, we also had Eyes Like the Sky come out so quickly afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I didn't even like, you know, stupidly at the time, and because we did such small pressings, it was always just like, we're lucky to get one each, you know. Mm-hmm. I think I still have a copy of each of them though, the originals. Mm. But the spines on a few of them, like especially the 12 bars, like I don't know how they were made. They're just made poorly. They were kind of split and stuff.
Okay. All right. And then, like you said, Eyes Like the Sky, narrated by your father.
Yeah.
So how did that come to be?
We did Sam Cherry's Last Shot on 12 Bar Brews, and that was just like this Western thing. And, you know, that all just came from us being obsessed with Spindrift at the time, that God's Gun, what's the spin, Speak to the Wind and stuff, that track, like I forget that album, but that album we used to smash heaps, and we just really wanted to do something, you know, like that, I guess. And Stu did the Sam Cherry's Last Shot, and he was also reading like Blood Meridian at the time, and Cormac McCarthy and stuff, and he wanted to like just literally get like an American or like someone, I forget who wanted to get, but then I was just like man, my dad's like obsessed with cowboys and Indians, like he would love to do this. Mm-hmm. And yeah, then he wrote like the Sam Cherry's Last Shot thing, and then from there, yeah, he just like, dad just went ahead and wrote this whole storyline about Miguel O'Brien, and yeah, I think that's one of the coolest things dad's written, that whole plot is really cool. Yeah, he sort of did that, and then Stu just sort of was making the music at the time, and then Stu just sort of slotted it in where it made sense with the music, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah, whilst listening to the voiceover he'd done.
Have you guys ever considered performing it live with your dad narrating?
We did at Gizfest a couple of years ago, 2018, I think. We got him up and we did a couple of songs. I really want to. I would love to try and bring him to like Red Rocks or something and do it there. I've been thinking about just like, yeah, paying out of my own money just to like get him to come.
Red Rocks would be the perfect environment.
Yeah, I know. But I don't know, like something like that would be awesome. One day I definitely want to try and convince him to fly over. I'm just worried now with COVID and stuff. He's like 75. I think he's like, yeah, turned 75 next week. But yeah. Anyway, so yeah, I think he came up with a whole second, like a sequel, but we never got around to doing the music or doing the album. Because I don't know, it doesn't really feel like it needed to be done again.
Right. In 2017, King Gizzard announced 5 albums for the year, which extraordinarily ambitious. Was it a struggle to complete those 5 albums, or did you already have enough to know that you'd be able to meet that commitment?
Yeah, that was a bit of a wild call at the time, kind of. Well, because we had like 3, and then like the fourth one, the ideas were like kind of there, but the fifth one was not. There was like off cuts though from all of them. So I think Stu just got excited on the radio and just was like, 5 albums. We're just like, okay, you heard it.
And so he hadn't talked to you guys about it at all.
Nah. And he just blurted it out. And then he was just like, I remember Eric just like being like, so freaked out. But he put it on himself, because it comes down to Stewie as well at the end of the day with those situations. If he makes a call, he'll make it happen. Mm-hmm. But yeah, by the end of it was so nuts. Like, we were in New Zealand and me and him were sharing a room, and like the like aircon was like broken, like not working properly, and it was like super hot in December. And I've got photos on my film camera, and he's just sitting there like cross-legged, just like on his laptop with like a microphone and headphones, just like looking like death, like trying to like trying to finish off Gumboot Soup, like making cabs go into the venue before the show, like during the day, to record drums on like songs. And cabs was like so off it, like, because we're all like just wanting to have a break at that point, you know, and just go to the beach for a minute or something. And Stu was just like, come on guys, we're gonna finish off this fifth album. And everyone's just like, motherfucker.
Well, you can tell it must have exhausted the band, because you guys didn't put anything out for the whole of 2018, right? So
yeah, he ran it dry. But it's amazing. I can't believe we pulled it off, like, and releasing it all just up to like New Year's Eve, and throwing up tracks with just like Jace was just quickly just coming up with art like on the spot and just putting up single art. And yeah, Gumboot Suit turned out to be probably one of my favorite albums, really.
Mm-hmm. Cool. I mean, and it, you know, there's no quality suffrage from all that all that focus. Polygon to Wanaland, free album. Was that a concept early on to just give it away free and kind of see what happens? Like, what was the conversation like around that?
Again, I wasn't super present for that one. Like, I did some vocals and some harmonica and stuff on that one. I was there for a lot of the sessions and stuff, but I don't remember the point where they just decided to make it free. I think it was just Stu just being like, I think we may should make it free. I think, I don't know. I'm not sure how Joe and Cavs felt about it at the time. They'd been working pretty hard on it. But like, I think it was also just like, I think it was a really cool, it was just an experiment. It was just a real wild thing to try and see what would happen. And I think it's really cool.
Yeah, it's been extraordinarily successful. In fact, that was one of my entry points into the band. And I was, you know, and to top it off, it was an
awesome album.
Yeah.
As well.
But to give it away, it seems like, okay, everyone had to be on board with that, because that affects everyone. It's not like,
oh. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. But I think in amongst the whole five albums we're doing, it was sort of like, it's all right, I guess, whatever. I don't really remember much conversation about it. It was sort of just like, okay, cool, and no one really flinched too hard. You can't really, like, once Stu sort of has a vision in his mind, it's kind of hard to change it. But then then it like happens, and then you're like, well, all right, he's always kind of right, and he's got a good vision for like what things are going to be like. It's cool. Adds to the Gizverse.
Now, all this while, the Murlocs are still happening. You're recording, you're releasing materials on there. Was it pretty much assumed Murlocs were going to be on Flightless early on? Was that even much of a conversation? It was.
Yeah, it wasn't much of a conversation. Yeah, it was sort of like Gizzard. It was for Gizzard. Eric was starting a label for Gizzard mainly, and he was already managing Murlocs. So like, I remember I was playing Gizzard, and then we put out the first self-titled EP, and we played live to air at PBS in Melbourne. And I remember not long after that, like a couple of days after, Eric just called me and was like, yeah, I've been talking to Indra, who was booking Gizzard at the time. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to manage Murlocs, and Indra's going to book you guys. Is that cool? And I was just like, yes, great. So it just made everything in the family and made more sense, and then, so it's pretty much just us two. And then once the label started, it was just immediately like TPEP on CD and 12 Bar Brews and stuff. And then from there on.
Mm-hmm. With Loopholes, as I understand, during the recording of Loopholes, there was a break-in. The laptop was stolen. And a lot of the material you had to re-record. Do you recall what was lost forever?
I remember Stu's car. I think it was unlocked at the front of my friend's place in Carlton. And his laptop got stolen. And I think he was only in my friend's house for like 5 minutes or something. Like, it wasn't even long. I don't know. And I remember the time when he told me, I was kind of like, ah, shit. But I also like thought the performance and like the songs and stuff just weren't there anyway. So I was kind of quietly like, this is a blessing in disguise, I reckon. But like, some of the Murlocs were just like shattered. But I just knew it wasn't as good as it could be. And I still think it turned out to be not as good as it could have been. So we ended up re-recording it. I feel like some songs we've even re-recorded three times, and I feel like just some songs like Serial Imposter and like a couple songs on there were just pretty filler, and like, I don't know, I think we've done the two EPs, just because we were putting off doing the album. And then I feel like it's cool, it's definitely just its own thing. But by the time it came around to it being done, after like the laptop being stolen and re-recording songs multiple times, like there was points where like me and Cook decided to go down to Callum's house, a guitarist, to do some overdubs one weekend. And he's like, yeah, come down. Yeah. And we get there. He's like, oh yeah, I'm having a party though. And we're like, what? You're having a party? And then, like, we're trying to record, like, vocals in this bedroom, like, upstairs, and everyone's, like, climbing out the window and drinking on the roof and, like, hollering and having a good time. We have to, like, and my friends, like, you know, I'd finish a vocal, like, a line in the verse, and he'd just be like, fuck yes! Like, oh, it was just, like, mayhem. But, yeah, so that whole album was just, like, a real funny debacle. But we got there in the end.
Does it surprise you that, you know, early pressings of, like, Loopholes or Young Blindness, they go for several hundred dollars each? I mean, the collectability of the bands you're in is quite high. There's some fanatics that want everything, and the prices go high. What's the perspective on that?
Yeah, I don't know. I honestly don't really get it. I get that because it's like the smaller pressing and stuff. Yeah, but I've never really kind of quite got that level of like fanatic. But you know, each to their own.
Do you collect anything?
Not so much. I definitely hoard things. I definitely have lots of things. I try and hold on to memorabilia things a bit, probably more so than most of the members in both bands, maybe, I reckon. I don't know. I feel like I've got like a lot of like t-shirt designs we've done and like, you know, and records and just like clippings and things like that. But not so much. I'm trying to get better at not hoarding and holding on to too much things. But as far as collectibles go, probably just mainly heaps of broken harmonicas.
Is there an effort to archive or to collect various bits of King Gizzard or Warlocks or Flightless?
I feel like it's got past that point. It's worth collecting. I wish I collected a bit more in the early days, but I have like, you know, some like first like album reviews, first like live gig reviews and stuff, which is really cool to look back on. It's definitely lying around somewhere and probably at my mom's as well. But I feel like somehow, you know, being, you know, probably one of the biggest weed smokers in Gizzard or whatever, like, I feel like I'm going to have to write the biography one day because no one seems to, like, remember anything a lot of the time. And I somehow can remember a lot of things. So I really want to one day just go through all our tours, get all the dates down and all the shows and try and remember everything that happened in between. And get a ghostwriter or something because that would be cool.
Start taking notes now.
I say that. I was like, somehow I just can remember anything. One day I woke up and just it's all gone.
Well, we've had people on the show, like the guy who looks after the Jimi Hendrix archive or the guy who looks after the Queen archive, and they look after not only the master tapes, but all the, you know, gig posters and even stage wear, that sort of thing.
Oh, wow. Yeah. 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 I still hold on to, actually that reminds me, I need to go get my Manic Candid jacket and shirt from, Flightless. I think they still have that, but I've got like my Murlocs jumpsuits and, my like, still got this outfit for the Bittersweet Demons tour that I haven't even been able to wear yet. But I would love to do more outfits, but the pandemic sort of stuffed that up as well because I spent all this money on like outfits for Bittersweet Demons and now we've like not been able to play most of the shows. And by the time we will be able to play proper shows, we'll have a new album out and it's not going to work.
Or two.
Yeah, or two soon after. See how it goes. But
so, just the other day, there was a whole slate of King Gizzard dates for the U.S. So it sounds like you guys are having most of 2022 overseas now. Big changes, you know, coming up, especially with what's happened the last couple of years. What's on the cards there? Are you still going to be able to release as you go? Is it stressful? Is it welcome? I can tell by your body language it's maybe a little stressful.
Yeah, I think we all were just like, you know, last year and stuff when we were organizing it, we're like, you know, all just so frustrated and we're like, oh, screw it. Like, we just got to go hard. We're going to make up for all this lost time. Like, you know, we just got to go all out and just, yeah, just go for it, basically. And a few crew had hesitation, some more than others. And I was just so, like, pent up, you know, and I was just like, nah, like, I just say yes. Just say yes to all of it. Might not even happen, whatever, you know. You just got to give it your best shot at this point. Everything's so uncertain. So, yeah, but now, like, looking at, like, just this first run when we're going over in, like, mid-March, which is creeping up how soon, like, we're freaking out trying to practice and stuff. But, like, going over then, it's going to be, like, 3 months of, like, shows and things like that with, like, not that many breaks. And, like, the breaks are, like, travel days and things like that. So it's definitely going to be a very big testament to our mental health and friendships. Mm-hmm. But we're super lucky that we're all best mates and everyone's really level-headed. And some of the guys are bringing, like, their babies and partners and stuff. So that'll be cool as well. So it kind of, I don't know, we'll see what happens, you know, who knows. But that's, I think also we're trying to stockpile some stuff so we can keep releasing while we're right. smashing the road. Mm-hmm.
So you guys have had to cancel the Timeland festival in Melbourne, but there's a record made in Timeland. What is made in Timeland?
Made in Timeland is real funny album. It was, yeah, I don't even know what to even say about that or what I'm allowed to even give away anymore, but it was basically made to just, it's like an intermission sort of thing for like our 3 hour marathon sets. And then, yeah, I don't know. It's sort of shaped and shifted a bunch and now it's just turning into a bit of Illuminati. And I think Stu's just having a field day messing with everyone's heads about it too.
Mm-hmm. It's been pressed for months.
It has been pressed. Yeah. Yeah. I saw recently somewhere in Madrid, it ended up somehow in a record store in Madrid, like slipped through the cracks because we had the festival and I think we gave the green light to a bunch of people to start, you know, letting it be put out. But then we like canned it again. And then, yes, it slipped through the cracks in a few places maybe. But yeah, I don't know. It's sort of just like, we're just sort of hanging on to it because it's not like we don't want it to be such a big deal, but it's just turning into this big deal. So we're just kind of trying to quietly like pretend it's not a thing for a bit.
It's like Prince's Black Album. It's like, got out. There's a few of them that got out there and people have given it way more attention than maybe it deserved.
Yeah. It's definitely sounds like that then. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So there's still a big question mark on when the world will see that.
Yeah. It's definitely just got a question mark for sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Going to keep that mysterious.
So King Gizzard has moved over to Gizverse. Murlocs will be staying on Flightless. Is that the plan?
Yeah, more or less. I'm not sure. I'm just sort of still figuring out what to do and what's the best thing to do for the band as well, you know, because in these times, everyone's sort of going straight to distributor, you know, trying to think of ways that it makes more sense for the band to just put in a bit more work. And, you know, I don't know. I'm just sort of like it's hard to space things out and figure out what makes the most sense. But yeah, I think the next Murlocs album will be through ATO. And yeah, I'm not sure yet. It's all sort of just up in the air, to be honest.
So Ambrose, thank you so much for spending time with us here. I as an Australian of the last 20 years, I got to say the music that you guys are putting out has really given me so much hope. And a lot of pride, you know, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. knowing that sort of environment and that sort of community and that sort of art mm-hmm. is coming out of Australia, it really, you know, makes me feel very, very proud. I'm already a proud, you know, adopted Australian, but the fact that you guys are kind of making such a soundtrack that me and my family and my friends are kind of having for our lives and it's kind of homegrown here and
it's great.
Is great. And, I do want to let people know, if you're new to King Gizzard or the Murlocs, make sure you Google them up, especially the new album, Bittersweet Demons, UncleMurl.com. I think the album that really just ensnared me in the Murlocs is Manic Candid Episode. The writing on that, there are literally songs on there and melodies that bring me near weeping. They're so beautiful. And it was a pleasure speaking with you about all things vinyl and music. Again, just recommend people go to UncleMurl.com. The Murlocs are playing near you. Pick up a ticket. King Gizzard's playing all over the world the next year, so grab one of those as well. And Ambrose, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide, man.
Cheers, man. Thanks so much for having me.
That is just awesome. Ambrose, thank you so much for coming on The Vinyl Guide and sharing those stories and talking about that history. We'd love to have you back anytime. Again, I want to recommend folks go to UncleMurl.com. Check out the Murlocs tour dates. Grab some Murlocs vinyl. And of course, Gizverse.com for everything related to King Gizzard and the Lizard Wizard. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please share these episodes on your social media. Put them on your Facebook. Put them in your Facebook groups. If you got vinyl groups or if you're following different bands and this is relevant, put these links in the Facebook page. I'm sure the other record-minded fans in those Facebook groups would appreciate it. Of course, you could always tweet it out on Twitter, share a picture on Instagram, hell, even Xerox a bunch of flyers and nail them to street poles. I don't care. Just please share these episodes. That would be so much appreciated. And if you want to go a step further, you could always leave us a positive review on iTunes. That is huge currency. With us, just rock up and give us 5 out of 5, 10 out of 10, say something nice, make us blush, and we would absolutely love you for it. So we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Send your thoughts to Nate at thevinylguide.com or follow or tag us on Instagram at Vinyl Guide. Until next time, keep spinning.